You're listening to Body Banter, a podcast where we have conversations about the human body in all its forms and from as many perspectives we can find.
We are your hosts, Shagun Yedile
and Claudia Krebs.
And we are professors of anatomy in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada.
Anatomy is for everybody and every body, and we're here to get the body banter going.
We hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Body Banter. My name is Shagun Yedile, and I speak to you today from Kelowna. Kelowna is in the traditional, unceded, and ancestral territories of the Silk Okanagan Nations. As usual, I have Claudia with me today. Hi, Claudia.
Hey, Shagun. Nice to see you. I'm joining you from the UBC Vancouver campus on the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and occupied territory of the Musqueam Nation. And we have a special colleague with us. I've known Theo for many years from the American Association for Anatomy, and I am so thrilled to have you on the podcast today. Hi, Theo. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited. A longtime listener, first time caller. I'm Theo Smith. I use the pronouns he, they. I'm an assistant professor of anatomy at Touro University, California. And I'm finishing my first year serving as the director of diversity, equity, and inclusion for our college down here in lovely Vallejo, California, where the prices are high, but the temperature is so beautiful. So it's worth it.
We're kind of jealous, eh?
It's weird for a Midwesterner. I'm used to seasons. They don't do that here. It's very weird.
We do have seasons, and the weather's better than it was this morning right now. So I'm not going to complain too much. You have a full portfolio there as the Director of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, and then an Assistant Professor of Anatomy. And on top of that, you have a lot of research interests and a lot of scholarly interests. I want to start by talking about this really important article that you published in the Anatomical Record for their special edition a couple of years ago. And that was about queer anatomists and representation of queer anatomists and queer anatomy. Why don't you tell us what led you into that research and what you found and where things are now?
Yeah, that was a very unique and defining project for me. A lot of my own education is so tied into my own queer identity and coming out. I didn't come out professionally until we had some medical students who were trying to advocate for more queer health in their curriculum. And my PhD program was intertwined with theirs. So we were taking a lot of the same classes. I was TAing in their courses, and they didn't have that representation. So that just, I don't know, my teacher brain kicked in. It's like, boom, this is what you're supposed to do. It's time. You gotta step out. So in doing that, I started doing more safe zone training and more qualitative research, looking at professional identity development and how queer medical students respond to stress, because they respond a little differently than their heterosexual peers. But at the same time, they were having higher rates of mental health issues, even compared to their heterosexual peers in medical school. And that relationship and how they navigated that was interesting. And that sort of led to, as I started a faculty position, how do I represent LGBTQIA plus issues in material? I often got the feedback of, I don't understand how this is relevant. We all have the same anatomy, which not exactly true. There's so much variation and so much that goes undiscussed because it doesn't fit into this norm, this mythical norm that we've established. So that's really where I started getting into a lot of, I immediately jumped into our course here. It was during COVID, which was already a wild time to teach. But I said, I want to do the pelvis and perineum unit. If that's okay, that's where I'd like to jump in. And my colleagues, Andrea Taylor and Mark Tieford, were awesome about it. And I went through my plans with them. And they're like, yeah, let's do it. Let's try to get to a more inclusive place. Touro is very centered around social justice in medicine, and it just really fit a lot with a lot of the other program aspects. So we started there, and it's been an evolution from, you know, changing our terminology, not using just male, female, or even the little like astrological signs that I always forget which one's which, because I don't know. I can't ever remember. This year, starting to have a conversation of how do we move anatomy that we see in intersex patients and those with differences of sexual development, how do we move that into the conversation of talking about the anatomy of the pelvis and perineum? Because that representation is not there, but it's something I want my students to be prepared to see and understand and know this isn't weird or bad or anything. This is part of the human experience. This is how some of us show up to the game, and that's okay. So how do you help that patient in the most respectful way possible? That's really sort of where I keep coming back to of, you know, the quote unquote staying in my lane. It's how do I make them prepped for everything?
Yeah, thanks, Theo. That's such a moving story. And I like your story and how it evolved and how it was something that students demanded, something that students, you know, they were looking to see how they could build representation and inclusiveness into the teaching and into the models and the language and in the content that they do in class. And I like the story of how that then intersected with your own personal journey in you coming out and as a faculty, you know, and being the champion that the students were looking for. You know, so I wonder how, you've told us a little bit about that, how it's been from there. Now it's you're helping to bring up more of these issues. Like, I like the fact how you say that it's something that was in the shadows, but it was an everyday experience for a lot of people, and how everything is being centered. I just wanted to talk more about how you center your work, you know, in your experience for your students in terms of the profession itself, to say that, look, this is not something weird. It's not something that we should be ashamed of. It's something that, you know, built in respect for our patients. This is something our students are going to experience in their profession. Can you talk more about how you center the conversation in the work that you do?
Yeah, it's an important part of the process, because I like to learn about all sorts of different things and talk about how it's even remotely related. And that's not exactly maybe sometimes the best use of class time. So I'm constantly thinking about that. And I think it comes down to two different aspects. The first one, what do my students want or need? I start there. I hate to separate it this way, like a new generation of students, but we really do have a very new perspective of physician to be coming into our classrooms, where they're like, I'm not here just because I want the title or I want, and I think that, you know, if that's what you want, perfectly valid. I get it. I love having doctor in front of my name. It's very, ooh, this is nice. That was a dream. That was part of it for me. They're there because their communities aren't being served at a level that is reaching a point where they can thrive. We have a lot of students who come from the Central Valley of California, and they return there after their schooling to serve the communities that they come from. And I love that. I'm a small town kind of person. 2,000 people in the town that I grew up in. That's where I'm at all the time, even living in larger places. So their needs as these folks who are going to go out and really start to make that change is key. The other aspect is really coming to teaching as a patient and as my own experience as a patient. I'm lucky where I have a number of privileges. I'm white. I present as male, and that mitigates a lot of bias in my direction. But in the process of coming out, especially in the medical field, it's been interesting to see how attitudes or approaches have changed. My family physician, for one, when I came out, I could feel the shift of how my care was being handled and how he was interacting with me, just in one appointment. And, you know, luckily that was a time where I'm moving and going to grad school. So it's like, cool, I'm just going to find a different physician. But that experience as a patient, and especially a queer patient who's coming in and asking these questions that I also know aren't necessarily part of the medical education process, is really interesting. And to bring it back full circle and bring it back to the classroom for this next generation, that's really important for me and for the members of my community and the intersecting identities that come through that community. It's key.
Theo, I hear you. I think there's a lot to sort of unpack in what you just said. I mean, there's the sort of bias, homophobia that is just under the surface for a lot of people, and for some people, not even under the surface. And so that's something to contend with all the time. And as we're educating the next generation of physicians, we hope to mitigate those biases and hopefully educate them in a way that they don't have homophobia. And I agree with you, anatomy education is a huge part of that. As you're exploring sort of how to teach the anatomy of the pelvis and perineum, which is sort of, for many people, the focal point of this discussion, even though that is extremely reductionist, how has that changed your understanding of that area of anatomy? And how has it changed your teaching approach? Because it goes beyond not using male-female as a binary. Can you dive a little bit deeper? I'm so curious on how you understand the teaching of this region and how you experience that.
It's a great question. I think, to put it in a nutshell, and I'll go deeper, but just to throw this out there, it's about questioning why things are the way they are. My dissertation focused a lot on how expertise is created, if you will, and how the brain develops in organizing knowledge. And it's been interesting to see that in myself as I develop as a professional, but to see it in my students as well, and see who comes in with a more open mind, that's maybe not the best phrase, open mind, but who comes in with this understanding that not everything fits in category A or category B. And I'm not even just talking about when we get to pelvis and perineum anatomy, I'm talking about variations in how the brachial plexus shows up, variations in head and neck anatomy, heart. We start with heart in our course, and it's a beautiful place to start. Because it's a place where a lot of our students are familiar in some ways. They understand what we're looking at, but they get to see the variety and the spectrum that anatomy can appear in. And we get to start that.
Sorry for interrupting.
No.
Have this thought in my head. Do you think people are more accepting of variability in heart anatomy or brachial plexus anatomy than they are in variability of perineal anatomy?
Oh, I would say probably yes. And that's because when we get to start talking about pelvis and perineum, we bring in a huge sort of social aspect to that, from, you know, us naming pudendal meaning shame, to have shame or to be shamed, and using that to describe that area. I mean, just from the naming of it, we're attaching some social aspect to the anatomy. And it's incredibly interrelated. And this isn't anything new. And the Queer Anatomy article, it was fascinating to see how much of we know about anatomy in the 1700s, 1600s, because it was so related to the legal system and who was allowed to have rights, who was allowed to vote, who was allowed to get married. And for a piece of anatomy to have that much power and that much stature, it's incredible. I don't think there's maybe any other part of the body that does. The brain is big, the heart is big, but I don't think we're disagreeing a ton about how that should look or show up or develop, you know? And I think that's fascinating. It's weird as a queer anatomist for me to be so invested and so, like, I want to teach pelvis and perineum because I feel that that's just reducing me to that. But there's such depth there, and there's so much that's unexplored. I mean, as a graduate student, it was surreal for me to be teaching college-age students essentially sex ed in some cases, because I worked in a state that didn't really cover that up until that point. And to share that information, but not be having like the experiences that these college students were having, or the being in the social space that they were, the heterosexual space, it was amazing, because I'm like, I thought this was just how it worked, because no one teaches you queer sex ed. No one teaches you that. There's great books now, but not in the early noughts. So that relationship of how that all bonds together is so key to me. So it's why I try to take such reverence in how we talk about it and how we go about it, because that has been put on the anatomy. I didn't do that. That was already there. And I understand the importance of that relationship. So how do we continue that, but also bring more people into that conversation?
Absolutely, Theo. Wow. That's such an amazing sequence of events, and some of the things that you're sharing, how your students coming almost naive to sex ed, and it's up to the professor to be introducing them to that area. And it again reinforces how anatomy comes into the social sphere, or actually maybe it's the social sphere that imposes itself in anatomy. As there's a definite thing going on there, how students come in already having ideas, having been formed in their own social spheres, and they bring that into anatomy and expect it to be that way, and then you're exposing them to a whole new knowledge about possibilities and of actually how other people live. And I wonder whether you can expand on that, because yes, you're getting more and more well known for your work and for who you are, and how your students hopefully carry, you know, a little bit of you and a bit of the things you teach them into their social relationships. I'm wondering whether you've had any kind of feedback from the society or from the broader, maybe even college, even your university at large, some other conversations, and maybe you can relate it to your work now as the director of inclusion and diversity, whether some of these conversations are being had in a broader perspective, in a broader campus or even city, or more broadly the society at large. How is that interaction working, that connectivity between campus and outside of campus and between anatomy and the societal space?
Oh, we need 5 to 10 hours. I mean, there's a lot there. I think in many ways I'm very lucky being in California, especially the Bay Area, which has a very rich queer history. That is very beneficial, where, you know, a lot of my friends who grew up here, this isn't novel to them in many ways, but in other ways, it's interesting because you see there are pockets still of groups who are like, I don't understand the importance of this. I don't understand. Why are we talking about this? There are bigger problems. And I'm not saying, you know, being more inclusive in teaching pelvis and perineum is going to solve everything at all, but I think it could solve some things. And this is just where I'm the expert. So this is where I'm working. Feedback wise, it's been very interesting because I do have students that, you know, from all over the country and even the world. And there isn't, I get feedback from queer students. I had a student last year who emailed me after we did pelvis and perineum and said, I've never seen this before. I'm queer. I went to college in Texas. We didn't discuss this. And to have it so nonchalantly just be part of what we did, he's like, that was amazing. And that for me is the piece that I am taking, not taking from them, but that they give me that I get to carry now, because I didn't have that experience when I started coming up. I think the first time I sort of started seeing going beyond, you know, this is male, this is female, was in graduate school at IU Bloomington, Valerie O'Loughlin. She started that conversation. We didn't have time to dive into it, but just that little acknowledgement of, you know, this is not how you've seen it necessarily organized before. There's more here. That was great for me as an academic, because it was like, cool, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to dive in, right? I'm supposed to learn more. So that piece of feedback has been really nice to see the students who are coming in getting an experience that, now me knowing what I do know, that's what I want. That's really nice. I get feedback every now and again of like, you know, it's not relevant. We're just teaching anatomy. That's all you need to do. I've had students who say, you know, hey, you don't have to put in like gender affirming care anatomy into your slides, especially if it's going to take you longer. And it's just one slide that I have in there, and it's to show how the surgery uses our knowledge of embryological development to change whatever anatomy is being wished to be changed. That's it. That's the point of it. It just happens to be gender affirming care because there's a lot there. So I'm very lucky that I'm shielded in many ways. And some of my colleagues aren't, and figuring out how to assist them, especially with the current legal situation in the States right now, is a big topic that keeps me up at night.
Yeah, it doesn't just keep you up at night. I'm certain there's many who are very worried about the future of queerness in the United States at this point. But bringing it back to your experience in the classroom and your story, I put in the chat earlier, I got goosebumps from what you were saying, right? Because I think it is so relevant and so brave to do this. And here at UBC, we also teach in a sort of inclusive way. And I actually say, what do you do when you got more people showing up? You put more chairs around the table. It's okay, right? Like nobody's going to lose out on this. And for our students, it's often also the first time that they hear it so explicitly and grounded in science. in a society that, not just in the US, but I think globally, is getting more skeptical of science and trusting science less and less, trusting experts less, and not believing science, which is always, for me, it's like there's nothing to believe. It's just data. It's just facts. I don't know what, you know. How do you see your own educational practice evolving in that climate? And how do you see people's understanding of not just their own body, but the bodies around them evolving? Because I think most of us think that the people around us are much more similar to us than they are, right? Sort of a bias that we all carry in us. How do we cultivate this curiosity and open mind and open heart to diversity and ground that in science? That's a lot. Sorry, we're dumping a big questions on you today, Theo.
I love it. This is really exciting. These are the questions I ask myself, but you're putting it so much more eloquently. So I love it. I think for the first part, how does my teaching evolve and how does in sort of the skepticism that is coming up? I think there's a few different parts of that. The part that I think I focus on most in both of my jobs are the skepticism that has arrived and developed because the individuals who have that skepticism, their identities were not in the data collection, the research, the work that was done initially. I get that. We saw this in COVID-19, where we had technology that is incredibly commonplace in healthcare, the pulse oximeters not working correctly because people of color were not involved in the testing and development of those technologies. So I get that skepticism, that I'm there. I understand it. And I understand that there is a type of knowledge, especially as a queer person. And I'm not a monolith. I'm not the only person having this experience. And there are plenty of folks who have way different experiences than I do as a queer individual. But there's a knowledge, an internal knowledge of who you are, that I think when it's not seen and not even acknowledged, just acknowledged from the so-called experts, yeah, I'm gonna be a little skeptical. When I, you know, see a colleague who is, or I'm reading something that really sticks to the binary of sex, I'm like, we're cutting out a whole chunk of the population that does not have this experience. And that includes the folks who might not know that they're having that experience, because how do you break sex down? It's not just genitalia, it's chromosomes, it's hormone levels. There's so many different aspects to how we've organized that. And those are all variables that can change in my head. You can just, everything else could be what you consider quote unquote normal, but there could be one part of that variable that's changed. And that's a different experience. That's your experience. So I think that sense of expertise and knowledge, when it's not acknowledged by the experts, that brings up some skepticism. And that's where I live. How do we not even bring them to the table? How do we break the table up, get rid of it, and we create the space that everyone can sort of sit at and be seen? And I know it's never going to be, we're never going to reach a level of perfection like that, but to shoot for it, to aim for it, that's where I sort of sit, of how do we do this the best way from the ground up instead of trying to retrofit on the way. And that comes back to the anatomy itself, the pelvis and perineum. How are we organizing that in textbooks? How are we organized? I think before me, I took over this position, there's a male repro and a female repro anatomy. I don't do that anymore. It's just pelvis. And we talk about here are these organs that are related, here are these organs that are related. And even with that, there's still a part of it that is, has been dedicated, it's still stuck in that binary. And in thinking about intersex patients and thinking about gender affirming surgery that can happen and the anatomy that my students are actually going to see, that's helping me actually take that step back and say, I have to rethink how to organize this completely. And from the get-go, there's space for all of those experiences and all of that anatomy to be seen and represented. I don't remember the second part of your question. I apologize, but I was stuck there for a little bit.
That was great. Thank you. I think the other part is kind of how we change the world. That's always my next question. That's sort of how you approach it in the classroom. How do we change the world from there?
Together, end of the day. I have a very bad habit of not saying no and taking on a lot of projects. And a hard lesson that I've had to learn, and I'm still learning, is that this can't be done alone. Especially because my perspective is flawed, right? I only have X number of lenses. I didn't think about adding intersex anatomy or how we talk about that or approach that in anatomy education until last year when I was reading two amazing memoirs that have come out by intersex activists, two vastly different memoirs, very different experiences. And in that sense, because I was able to peek into their experience, that was a key part for me to then come back to my area and start asking those questions. So exposure for the skepticism from a broader society, from as a whole, it's that representation is key, but it doesn't, I think we're sort of at the point where a lot of people end there. They're like, oh, you're seeing, okay, now we have a movie that has an Ariel of color. There's a Little Mermaid of color. Great. I love that movie. Absolutely love it. What do we do beyond that? Now that we've seen that experience, now that we have broken through whatever mystical barrier that was there to be okay with this and it be fine, I want to know what's next. And that's where we start coming back to our spheres and asking the questions. Okay, are we addressing this? Are we missing out on something in this area, in our home base, our comfort zone? And that's terrifying. It's terrifying. There are a lot of areas of DEI that I have not done in-depth reading and looking into because of my own biases, of my own experiences. Weight bias is one of them. It's a very hard topic for me to talk about and read about. But it's a slower process of, okay, how do we navigate this? But I don't have to do it alone. I have amazing colleagues, especially in the AAA. I just reviewed a wonderful article that's going to come out soon about weight bias in anatomy education. And it changes. It changes everything. It changes. It makes that shift. And I love that.
Yeah. Can I say I'm such a fan, Theo?
Ditto. Ditto.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your work. Because, you know, just the fact, and this is what people don't realize, that we are not saying that we know everything and that we've seen everything, but we are willing to say, this is what I know. At least I'm an expert in my body. I'm expert in my experience. And I'm willing to acknowledge that other people have other experiences too. So let's have a conversation and talk about these things and how everyone can be represented and everyone can have a place, you know, in these conversations. And so thank you so much again for all that you do. Because what you said reminded me of, obviously, of course, of your workshop, your symposium at last year's AAA in DC. And I forget, I'm sorry, the name of the co-presenter who also talked about how and it comes to what you just said about the paper you're just reviewing, how that this has real world consequences, the ability to recognize, you know, something like you've said about COVID and how people of color were not tested in you know, pulse oximeters. And then it's turning out it's not giving the accurate results, that these biases, these failure to bring everybody along and have a holistic view of different types of bodies actually have real world consequences. And so at that symposium, I was really glad about, you know, the discussion about how, you know, especially in education, in med school and other professional schools, fat shaming, you know, using even terminologies that, oh, this particular donor, oh, you're going to have a hard time getting through the tissues because it's so fat, you know, and all of that, and how we really have got to change, you know, change from within and change our language and change our attitude about when we've encountered a different body that is not typical or heteronormative, and how we need to start within the academy and then hopefully go to where we've been talking about previously, changing the world, one conversation at a time, one person at a time. And I just wanted you to speak to that, how having a holistic view of different bodies and just having an openness to encounter different types of experiences, how that enriches the conversation and helps actually in patient care at the end of the day. I'm not to revisit your whole symposium all over again, but
it's a great question. It comes back to, actually, sorry, I can't get this out of my head. I had, I think they were a high school student yesterday. We're running a pathways program for high school and early college students to get more exposure to medical health sciences. And I got to work with them yesterday. And I was talking about how the textbook we use in anatomy, it's Gray's Anatomy for Students. A new version came out, and at the beginning of the urogenital system, they have a lovely, it's not a ton of stuff, but it is a lovely just acknowledgement. And here's how we're going to talk about things. And here's who we might not cover in this, because there's such a unique experience of being trans or being intersex. But this is the respect we want to move forward with in our language. Which I saw and just started crying. My partner was like, what's happening? You're reading a textbook and you're crying. What is going on? And I was just so happy. And I was telling them this story because they were so up to date on their terminology and how to approach things with inclusiveness that I've just not experienced. So I was telling them a story, and one of the students still asked, you said they talked about non-binary individuals. Do they have different anatomy? And I'm like, okay, we still have work to do. We still have things to talk about. We still have deeper places to go, even within all the progress. And that comes back to the patient support, because so often I'm hearing from the community, from friends, from loved ones, of I can't go see this physician anymore because I asked them to take over my hormone treatments. And they're like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to help you. I don't have that training. Yet they've most likely been trained in HRT for older women. It's a little different. It's not too different. That commitment to patient care for me is just creating an environment where the clinician feels comfortable and prepared and having the resources to treat a patient, because otherwise they're not going to get treated. They're going to have to go, you know, miles away. I actually travel. We have a Kaiser, and this is not about Kaiser at all, but we have a a Kaiser Institution in Vallejo here. It's 10 minutes away. I actually travel an extra 15, 20 minutes, which I know might not sound far, but in the Bay, that's forever, to see a specific clinician, my general physician, because she has LGBT issues in her bio on the Kaiser website. She's one of the few. I made that, like, I will follow her anywhere. So that commitment that to having the exposure, I think that's what it comes back to, of having those conversations.
Thanks for that, Theo. I think it's a really great way to summarize this entire conversation, that it really comes back to the healthcare provider who has that as part of their language and their portfolio and their understanding. And that's really what it's about. And then for the rest of the world, it'll be one conversation at a time that we'll continue to have. You work a lot, obviously, as an anatomist with human bodies, and in your scholarship, you explore all of that. What's your favorite body part?
Oh, I'm glad I did my homework. I usually tell students, because students will ask, they always ask, I usually tell students the gallbladder, and then they'll ask why, and I'll say, because it's really the only organ that is the same color in the donor as it is in the book, because they like to falsely color everything, and then students are like, this artery isn't red, what's going on? I'm like, yeah, I know, it gets harder, just wait, they're not labeled either. But I think more at the heart of especially this conversation, cranial nerve 11. Absolutely. It makes me ask questions and it frustrates me. And I love that. And I get to dig deep with it. So that's my favorite.
Okay. We're going to have a longer conversation around cranial nerve 11, because I have issues with cranial nerve 11.
It's controversial.
I call it the imposter nerve, you know, just sneaking back into the cranial cavity to become a cranial nerve. Like, what were you thinking? And then that weird thing with sternocleidomastoid on one side, trapezius on the other. Like,
okay, you folks are just nerdy.
It might be our least favorite body part as well.
It's a love-hate relationship. Absolutely. It's a love-hate relationship.
Do you have a least favorite body part, Theo?
Oh, yeah, I do. And I'm going to get a lot of pushback for this one, because I come from an anthropology world. And this is how I knew I wasn't going to be an anthropologist. Teeth. Teeth. I can't. I appreciate those who do, who are all about them. It doesn't get me excited. It doesn't get me out of bed in the morning. I just can't do it. And that's like a lot of anthropology. And I love it. It's a wonderful field. I still dabble, but teeth.
Oh my, wow. Your answers are just kind of, you know, inspiring deeper questions, you know, about teeth and about, you know, the anthropology of teeth, and then the social aspect of teeth, and, you know, and yeah, I don't enjoy visits to the dentist at all. And you wonder, yeah, if we could have done without teeth, maybe that would have been better.
Can we talk about the inclusion of teeth in horror? Like, I remember watching this movie with my kids who are all about horror movies, and there was a monster that was covered in teeth, and it was like 5 minutes in, and I'm like, and I'm out. I cannot watch this.
The Tooth Fairy? That's a terrifying thing. This thing is sneaking in and stealing parts of your body? What? That was always terrifying to me. And they've implemented it in horror now, too. And I'm like, I wasn't wrong. This is scary. It's weird. And yeah, no, teeth.
Yeah, this just tells me that we'll have to have you back again sometime, Theo, to explore some of these things. But thank you
anytime.
So much. Thank you so much, Theo Smith, for being part of our Body Banter today. It's been such a fascinating conversation that took us from like your journey through academia, and then your personal experience to student teaching, to curriculum, to societal change. And I really do hope that folks listening will have really enjoyed this episode and taken lots of learning points from here. Thank you. Claudia?
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Theo. I certainly have taken a lot of learning points from here, and I hope to continue the conversation so that we can continue to change the world. And I hope that many people will join the conversation. Theo, we'll put your contact info in the description of the podcast so people can reach out to you for collaboration and further conversations. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for being here. And that concludes another episode of Body Banter. Till next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Body Banter.
We are Claudia
and Segun.
And we look forward to having you join us for more conversations about the human body next time.